All right, I started describing slide 13 in words before we actually got to the picture you're looking at. This shows you a graph of membrane potential for cardiocytes rather than, to compare it in your mind to one you're already familiar with, a similar trace for skeletal muscle cells, right, which are excitable cells. There's a couple glaring differences, actually three. One is that, this is what I started describing last time, you don't have a steady membrane, resting membrane potential in cardiac myofibers, or cardiocytes, or cardiac myocytes, or whatever you want to call them, heart muscle cells. Instead, you have a steadily increasing potential that is sub-threshold, meaning that it's always getting closer to threshold. So instead of having a resting membrane potential, which would stay there unless something outside of the system perturbs it, what you have is called a pacemaker potential, meaning there's a built-in system, or there's a built-in attribute of the system that allows for these cells to be autorhythmic. They bring themselves to threshold. It doesn't take a neuron to cause an action potential in cardiac muscle, unlike skeletal muscle. Skeletal muscle is just going to stay relaxed and keep at membrane or resting membrane potential unless a neuron tells it to fire. Okay, that's one big difference. That's why you don't have any horizontal line here. Another difference is the time scale. A single contraction, a single action potential in cardiac muscle cells is much longer. Notice this is not in milliseconds, which is what the scale usually is used in when you look at an action potential graph for a skeletal muscle cell. This is in seconds. So thousands of milliseconds. Or there's 1,000 milliseconds right here to get to 1 second. And therefore, when we talk about a twitch in a skeletal muscle cell, that is a contraction due to just a single action potential, which is a very short duration. That wouldn't be helpful for the cardiac muscle cells to operate this way. When they contract, there's only one thing they're doing, right? They're contracting in order to expel blood from one chamber to another, or from one chamber into an artery. And that takes a certain amount of force and a certain amount of time for that blood to be expelled. So, contraction of the heart chambers isn't just a milliseconds long twitch. It's about a second long process, almost. Half a second to a second. And the third glaring difference is that in addition to the two types of ions involved in skeletal muscle contraction, you have calcium in the mix here as well. So there are sodium ion channels involved, there are potassium ion channels involved, and they work the same way that they work in skeletal muscle, here in heart muscle. But in addition to those, you have calcium ion channels. Calcium, notice, is also a cation. It's an example of a divalent cation because each individual calcium ion is carrying two positive charges rather than just one. But all three players here, all three ion types, are positive ions. How is it that you can have nothing but positive ions but still have different directions that the overall charge is going? Well, the fact that there's more on one side is what causes them to diffuse when the channels are open. But how is it that you can use positive ions to make the potential go up on the graph in one instance, and use positive ions to make it go back down in another instance. It's a boring part of the recording. No guesses? What I'm saying is it's a positive ion causing this upswing. It's also a positive ion causing the downswing. Why is that? No, there aren't any negative ions involved here. That's the point. They're all positive ions. So how can positive ion flow lead to an upswing in the graph, and positive ion flow causes downswing in the graph later? Hmm? What do you mean by that? The difference is the direction in which the flow is happening. Right? So keep in mind that before anything happens, and we would say that if we were talking about skeletal muscle, we would say at rest. Well, there's really no at rest in the heart because you have this pacemaker potential, so you don't have a steady membrane potential ever. But before anything happens, and this is true even in unexcitable cells, the extracellular fluid is different from the intracellular fluid. That membrane not only is a separation of spaces, but it maintains different chemical compositions in these two fluids. So what do you know about the extracellular fluid compared to the intracellular fluid? In general, not just for heart cells, all cells in your body. Well, it's true that there is a negative membrane potential at the inner surface of the membrane. Not fully inside the cell, but just on that inner surface. And there's a positive charge just on the outer surface of the membrane. But why is that? That's a minor reason. Very minor reason. What explains the membrane potential for any cell, whether it's excitable or not? Yeah, you have sodium, potassium pumps working continuously, right? Throughout your lifetime, about 40% of your energy budget goes into just using those pumps. What do those pumps do? They create two gradients. What two gradients? What two gradients do the sodium-potassium pumps produce? You're not saying it loud enough for the class to hear. Right. It separately produces a sodium gradient and a potassium gradient. Now back to my original question. What can you say about the extracellular fluid compared to the intracellular fluid vis-a-vis these two ions? True. What does the pump actually do? It moves sodiums and potassiums around, right? But tell me what it specifically does. What is it doing to sodium? Right. The sodium-potassium pump pumps sodium ions out of the cell into the intracellular or extracellular fluid. What about potassium ions? Right. That same pump pumps potassium ions into the cell. So now you can answer the question I've been asking. What can you say about extracellular fluid in that case based on the operation of this pump? Right. Extracellular fluid has a higher sodium ion concentration than intracellular fluid. Intracellular fluid has a higher potassium ion concentration than extracellular fluid. the existence of those two gradients is the only reason why those ions diffuse through open channels in a certain direction. Right? But notice that the directionality, even though they're both positive ions, the directionality of their gradients is opposite to each other. So if a sodium ion channel opens up, which way does sodium flow? Into the cell, down its own gradient. It's a positively charged ion, so what's that going to do to the interior? Or more positive, yes. That's why the one flow of a positive ion causes an upswing. Because what you're doing with that positive ion is bringing it into the cell. Okay? That makes the inside more positive. When you open up a potassium ion channel, what is the flow? Outward flow, efflux. Well, that's the difference. Yes, it's another positive ion, but now it's leaving the cell. So when you take positives out of the cell, you're leaving the cell less positive, more negative. That explains the downswing. So the reason that the same type of ion, positive in all cases, causes opposite effects to the overall membrane potential is because the direction of flow is opposite. And that's because sodium potassium maintains those gradients in opposite directions. Now, what do you know about calcium ions in general in the extracellular fluid? Well, in 201, what was the big deal about calcium ions? Why did we study those? They do various things, but what did we study in 201? They were involved in muscle contraction, yes, but before we even get to that point, in terms of a process, you're talking about skeletal muscle contraction. They did open up certain kinds of gates, and where were those gates? I'm sorry, they didn't actually open gates. In response to gated calcium ion channels opening up, they flowed through those channels. But where were those gated ion channels? Axon terminals. Yes, the end of neurons. And so when they opened up, they opened up as a direct result of the action potential that was created at the end of the neuron, right? When they opened up, which way did calcium flow? Into the neuron, yes. Which means what about the concentration of extracellular fluid for calcium? It's higher also. So keep that in mind. Extracellular fluid has a higher concentration of sodium ions and calcium ions than intracellular fluid. Just the reverse for potassium ions. Higher concentration inside the cell than out. Okay. So these pacemaker potentials, these occur in cells that make up the sinoatrial node. Okay, remember the SA node we talked about last time, which is the pacemaker of the heart? This is the population of cells that are responsible for creating an action potential periodically. Periodically doesn't mean just every now and then. Every now and then would be intermittent. Periodic means with regularity, at a regular frequency. Okay? Now, the reason that these pacemaker cells of the SA node have this diagonal pacemaker potential rather than a horizontal one is because there are certain proteins in the membrane of these cells that are acting as sodium ion channels, but these are not the same sodium ion channels that will be opened up once we're officially in the action potential. Think back to skeletal muscle cells. You had two different kinds of sodium ion channels there as well, right? Do you remember the two types? You had some ligand-gated sodium ion channels, and you had voltage-gated sodium ion channels. What did the ligand-gated sodium ion channels respond to? What opened them up? What was the ligand, in other words? No? Well, what tells a muscle cell to start creating an action potential? What? A neurotransmitter, but specifically. Acetylcholine, right. That's what the neuron releases. That's the signal. It's acting as a ligand, binds to a ligand-gated sodium ion channel, right? That is closed until that acetylcholine gets there. That's why there's no change in the membrane potential at rest. But when those ligand-gated sodium ion channels open up, now you have some sodium going into the cell that brings it up above resting and toward threshold. Well, in heart cells, you don't have ligand-gated sodium ion channels. You have non-gated sodium ion channels, meaning they're just always open. So you spend energy powering the ATP. I mean, you spend ATP energy to establish a sodium ion gradient, so there's always more outside than in, but you also have some leak channels, so that as it's being pumped out, some of it is diffusing in. And as that happens more and more over time, the inside is becoming slowly more positive. That's why you have this upswing. Okay? And it's just a linear increase because it's the same amount of flow happening during this time. Now, this is before the action potential. The threshold is still the magic voltage that causes an action potential to be initiated. But that threshold is going to be reached as long as you continue leaking sodium ions. That's what's happening here. All right, so that's one kind of sodium ion channel. But then you have, side by side with these leak channels, gated sodium ion channels. And what kind of gated sodium ion channels? Voltage-gated sodium ion channels. And what is the particular voltage that opens up their channels? Well, I don't mean numerically. What do we call it? The threshold voltage, exactly. So when enough sodiums have leaked through the non-gated sodium ion channels to bring that current potential to threshold, now you're at the proper voltage to suddenly pop open a whole extra population of sodium ion channels that are the voltage-gated sodium ion channels. You know, you're still leaking some sodium ions through those leak channels. Those are always leaking. But now you have a bunch of other open channels that are allowing a lot more sodium ion channel or ions to flow into the cell. And that's why you have a rapid rise in the membrane potential. That is the beginning of the action potential. Now that threshold voltage also opens up calcium ion channels. But calcium ion channels operate much more slowly than sodium ion channels do. And so do potassium ion channels, right? So the threshold voltage starts opening all three kinds, basically. But the sodium ion channels pop open instantaneously almost, whereas the other two take a little bit of time before they're fully open. Okay? And the other major difference, of course, is that potassium, unlike calcium and sodium, potassium ions, once they have open channels that they can go through, are not going to enter the cell. They're going to leave the cell, and that's going to make the cell interior surface of the membrane more negative, less positive, downswing in the graph. Well, let's look at this in slide 14 with an overlaid graph. The green trace here is the actual action potential. And notice how steep the rise is due to the opening of sodium or voltage-gated sodium ion channels. All right? Very, very quick. That's why it looks almost vertical. Or it looks vertical here. It almost is vertical in reality. Those sodium ion channels will close themselves, though, once the voltage peaks out. Remember that those sodium ion channels have inactivation gates as well as activation gates. So they shut themselves off. And therefore, sodium ions are really only responsible for the upswing part of the cardiac action potential. At the same time that they pop open, though, calcium ion channels are starting to open. They just take a lot longer to get there, to get open. And it's the calcium ion channels, voltage-gated calcium ion channels, that are and their slowness that is responsible for what we call the plateau phase of the cardiac action potential. You don't have a plateau phase in a skeletal muscle action potential, right? It's up and right back down. But in a cardiac myofiber, you have an upswing, a depolarization phase, just like it's called in skeletal muscle, but then it stays there, not perfectly, it's not a horizontal plateau, but it stays pretty high voltage for a couple hundred milliseconds, a couple tenths of a second, depending on the situation. All right? This allows the heart to contract long enough to act as an efficient pump. The plateau phase is what makes the overall action potential much longer in a heart muscle cell than a skeletal muscle cell. Now, the reason it's a plateau, well, during the plateau, calcium ion channels are open. And you would think that as long as they're open, it would continue to go higher and higher, right, on the graph. Why would keeping calcium ion channels and therefore allowing continuous flow of calcium into the cell keep it at roughly the same voltage? Because of the third type. The other slow to open channels are the voltage gated potassium ion channels. Okay? So during that plateau phase, you've already gotten up to a high voltage because of the sodium. And now you're bringing in calcium, which would tend to make it more positive, but you're also allowing efflux or outward flow of potassium, and those are undoing each other, right? Potassium flow is going to tend to bring it down, calcium flow tends to bring it up, and therefore, since they're both happening at the same time, it kind of plateaus out for a while and keeps it at that high voltage. But then calcium ion channels close while potassium ion channels are still open. Sodium ion channels long ago had already closed, and therefore at the end, all you have open channel-wise, other than the leak channels, are voltage-gated potassium ion channels, which means you continue to allow calcium to flow out of the cell. That's going to now, since it's not being counteracted by calcium, that means it's going to bring it down quickly. So that explains the rapid decline at the end of the action potential, the repolarization phase. So you have depolarization phase, plateau phase, repolarization phase that makes up the overall action potential. The depolarization phase is mostly due to influx of sodium through voltage-gated sodium ion channels. The plateau phase is due to a counterbalancing effect between open between flow of calcium ions and potassium ions, but in opposite directions because both types of channels are open. And then the repolarization phase is due to only voltage-gated potassium ion channels still being open at that point. The downswing not only brings it back to threshold, but beyond threshold to the deepest part of that pacemaker potential, and you'll start over now. At that point, all three types of voltage-gated channels are closed, and the only kind of ion flowing through are the sodium ions that are going through these leak channels. That's why it doesn't stay down there at that minimum. It will now steadily increase as more and more sodiums trickle in until it reaches threshold again, and then you have the next heartbeat because you have the next action potential. These action potentials, though, are starting, keep in mind, in the pacemaker potential, the pacemaker cells that make up the SA node. And those cells are modified. They've evolved to do just this job. Even though they are myofibers, they really don't contract. They just create the action potential, but then that action potential propagates from that cell directly to the actual muscular muscle cells, the ones that are contracted, the ones that can contract, the normal ones, through the gap junctions that we talked about last time and intercalated discs. So the pacemaker sets this pace of contractions, but these action potentials, but these action potentials, once they get out of the SA node and into the actual muscle cells, cause a wave of contraction throughout the entire chamber, and in fact through both atria at once, because the two atria are electrically in contact with each other. There's electrical continuity through gap junctions through both atria. That's why you only need one pacemaker, just in the left or in the right side. The two atria, though, are electrically insulated from the ventricles, at least as far as the muscle cells are concerned. And that's why the atria can both simultaneously contract while the ventricles are still relaxed. To get the ventricles to contract, you have to then transmit action potentials through those bundles we were talking about that go down as part of the interventricular septum and then branch upward at the apex. That's what brings action potentials a little bit later to the ventricles. So that atrioventricular node that we talked about, that is a specialized group of cells that actually have a fairly slow conduction. By conduction here, I'm talking about propagation of action potentials. So they propagate action potentials, but more slowly than the normal cardiac myocytes do. And this is why the ventricles don't receive the signal until a little bit later. That signal gets delayed by going through this slow to react atrioventricular node. Okay? But notice how this corresponds in red to overall contraction and relaxation. Myocardial contraction is occurring when you are above threshold it starts at the beginning of the action potential at the depolarization phase, but it continues during the plateau phase. Doesn't start to relax until the downswing. And so because of this extended time and during which we have a plateau, that means compared to skeletal muscle fibers, cardiac myofibers have a much longer absolute refractory period, which is important because you don't want to start a new heartbeat until the first one has done its job efficiently of propelling blood from that chamber. Okay? Let's go to 15 now and look at an example of an electrocardiogram, which is the output that a machine called an electrocardiograph makes. And this is just measuring electrical activity measured at the skin various points, but it's detectable at the skin. It's created, that electrical activity is created in the heart because of the flow of ions that we've been talking about. Ions are carrying charge, so we can detect this electrically as voltages. And in a normal, these electrocardiograms are used to diagnose various pathological conditions in a heart, but a normal trace looks like this, as a characteristic set of waves. And so there's various important points on this, P, Q, R, S, and T. Well, what's happening during the PR interval, or what's happening during this P wave, I should say, is that ions are flowing in the way we just described in order to cause the atria to contract. So there are action potentials created in the atrium. That's detectable at the skin as a P wave. So there are two words we should define, systole and diastole. Systole refers to the contraction phase of the cardiac cycle, whereas diastole is the resting phase. So before another action potential occurs, after the first one occurred, before the next one occurs, that's diastole. That's the only time the heart is resting. It's about half of your life, but it's systole, then diastole, systole, then diastole. Now, if we use these words by themselves, what we're usually referring to is what's happening at the ventricle, which are the more important chambers. So if you really want to talk about what's happening at the atrium, you would say atrial systole or atrial diastole. If you leave off the modifier term, then you're talking about what's happening at the ventricle, which is, importantly, the heart is in atrial systole while it's in ventricular diastole. The ventricle is relaxed when the atria are contracting. But anyway, the P wave is specifically electrical activity related to atrial systole, atrial contraction, as you see labeled on the bottom here. And the ventricles during that time are in diastole. Then you have, notice, a much higher peak, the R point of the so-called QRS wave, or the QRS complex as it's sometimes called, much greater in magnitude, corresponding to the much greater force of contraction and therefore electrical activity in the ventricles. So the QRS complex, or the upswing of that, corresponds to ventricular systole. And then the T wave, I should say specifically, that the R peak here corresponds to the depolarization phase of ventricular contraction, okay, which is the upswing on an action potential graph. Importantly, this is not an action potential graph, right? An action potential graph is what we just saw in the previous slide. But anyway, this R peak corresponds to ventricular depolarization, which would be an upswing on its own graph of action potential, or of membrane potential. The T wave, on the other hand, even though it's also a positive wave, it's caused by, at the skin surface is where this is being detected, remember, that's caused, though, by repolarization of the ventricles. So the downswing on a membrane potential graph causes this T wave after the R peak. Well, you might be asking, why does repolarization of the ventricles cause a wave, but repolarization of the atria does not? The answer is that it does, actually. The atria repolarizing would also cause a wave if all you had were atria that you could isolate. It's just that it occurs during this time when the ventricles greatly overshadow it. So the atrial repolarization wave is just hidden here in this QRS complex. All right. So that's the major points of a electrocardiograph. Let's make sense of it in slide 16, looking at what's actually happened at the heart at each of these. So first you have the atria beginning to depolarize. Notice that that's causing the P wave. All right, they're squeezing because of the action potential, and therefore they're increasing the pressure of blood in those chambers. After the depolarization is complete, they are going to repolarize, right? After the plateau phase, the atria are going to repolarize, come back down in voltage, but that's for membrane potential, not here. And now, action potentials are being sent. After being delayed at the atrioventricular node, action potentials are now going to be transmitted along the Purkinje fibers that we talked about last time in the bundle branches to directly jolt via gap junctions cells that make up the muscle cells that make up the ventricles themselves, but starting down here at the apex. And so that is when you have this drastic increase on the electrocardiogram, the R peak. That's when ventricles are beginning their systole. When the depolarization is complete, that brings it back down, but then you have a T wave during repolarization. After the ventricular action potentials plateau, then you have a repolarization bringing that back down. Well, that causes the T wave on an electrocardiogram. And then you're ready for another heartbeat.
Now, after the AV node, as far as that goes, would that be happening in three?
The AV node, no, in one. The AV node is the one that's leaking the sodium ion channels to bring it up to the first threshold to begin with.
Oh, so
then the SA node. The SA node would be operating right after here to cause the delay down to here so that the ventricles can still be relaxed until after the atria have contracted. Did I say that correctly? It's the SA node that sets the pace. It's the AV node that delays it. Is that how I said it? Because that's the truth. And that should make sense in your mind, right? The AV node is the atrioventricular node. That is farther down the heart. So that's the one that's causing the delay. The SA node sets the pace. The AV node delays that message for the ventricles. Okay, now to 17. Well, 17 is just a familiar example to demonstrate a pressure gradient. There's all kinds of gradients. A gradient is a difference in something from one point to another. In the case of pressure gradient, it means the pressure is higher somewhere than it is somewhere else. And this is why a syringe works the way it does. When you pull out the plunger, what you're doing is giving more area for these gas molecules inside it to move around, and therefore the pressure of those gas molecules is going to be decreased when you increase the volume, right? And that means now all of a sudden the pressure inside the syringe is less than the pressure in the atmosphere, which hasn't changed meanwhile. That creates a gradient. And so you don't really suck gas molecules in. What's happening is that you decrease the pressure inside so that the outer pressure, which is now higher, forces the molecules in. Pressure gradients always work so that there's going to be a flow from high pressure to low pressure. If you reverse the direction of the gradient by plunging it downward instead of drawing it out, now all of a sudden you bring the pressure up inside the syringe to a pressure that's higher than atmospheric pressure, and therefore the flow is reversed. Well, the reason this is shown here in this heart chapter is because pressure gradients are what open and close heart valves. Okay, for the atrioventricular valves, they open when atrial pressure is greater than ventricular pressure. They close when ventricular pressure is greater than atrial pressure. Semilunar valves, on the other hand, open when ventricular pressure is greater than the pressure in the artery that that ventricle leads to, either aorta or pulmonary trunk. And they close when the ventricular pressure gets small and now the pressure in the artery is bigger. In other words, when the pressure gradient gets reversed. And that's what these pictures are signifying. When the ventricles contract, that's after the atria have already contracted, and therefore now they are relaxed. That's what slams closed the atrioventricular valves. But at the same time, this increased pressure in the ventricle brings the pressure of that blood higher than the pressure in either the pulmonary trunk or the aorta, depending on which ventricle you're in. And that's what opens up the semilunar valves to eject that blood into the arteries. 19 is just a composite graph that brings this all together. So there's several different graphs happening at once here. Pressure traces on the top, as you see. Volume traces, so the higher it is on this graph, the more blood there is in that chamber or that structure. You have an electrocardiogram trace, and you also have heart sounds, which are what you hear as heart sounds are actually opening and closing of valves. But importantly, when you look at the pressure, notice that there's two traces. We don't care about the right side. This is the systemic circuit that we're looking at here. And so you have in black, or you have three traces, sorry. In black, you have left ventricular pressure at any given moment. All right. The red one, on the other hand, is left atrial pressure. And notice that when those two lines cross each other, black and red, that's when a gradient gets reversed. Right? Because one pressure that was higher than the other is now lower than the other pressure. So that's when valves open or close, depending on which has the higher pressure. So this first whole left section is diastole. Notice the upper labels. That means ventricular diastole. The ventricles are relaxed, right? And during ventricular diastole, during part of that, the end part of that ventricular diastole, is when the atria now have their own systole, right? That's when they actually contract. Well, that's going to pressurize the blood in the atrium. That's why this left atrial pressure is going up slightly there. And when it actually gets greater than or crosses the black line, that's when the atrioventricular valve opens up because you have a pressure gradient across that valve. And that's when blood then fills the ventricle. Once the ventricle contracts, then we're in ventricular systole. And notice that the black trace drastically gets high then because of the force of contraction of that ventricle. But not until that black line crosses the other red line, which is the pressure in the aorta, does the semilunar valve open. There's blood in the aorta from the last beat still. So there is a blood pressure in the aorta. Not until the ventricle contracts with enough force that the pressure in the ventricle gets bigger than the pressure in the aorta does that aortic semilunar valve open up and allow for blood to enter the aorta. That happens when the line crosses, when the lines cross. And then you just repeat this over and over. So this diastole is no different from this diastole. It's just one heartbeat later. Okay. Oh, and then just notice how the electrocardiogram trace matches up with this based on what we said the different parts of the electrocardiogram are. 20, and I think 20 is the last one. Usually we talk only about what happens in a normal or healthy adult. This is a pathological slide, though. Something going wrong here in both of these cases. It's important in a healthy heart for the two sides, left and right, to be contracting at a force that's appropriate for that circuit that they, that side of the heart serves. We've already talked about the fact that the left has to be stronger than the right because the systemic circuit has more resistance in it than the pulmonary circuit. But it's important to for each side to push basically the same amount of blood through these circuits if you want the overall travel of blood to be the same in the body. When a problem occurs, you could have a mismatch between the outputs of these two halves. And that can happen in either of two ways. Either the left can become weak or the right can become weak. So in A, notice that it says right ventricular output exceeds left ventricular output. Okay? That means the left half has gone weak for whatever reason. It's not pushing blood into the systemic circuit as much as it would normally. Meanwhile, the right is working the way it always has. But because now there is a mismatch, that means you're going to pressurize the pulmonary circuit more than the systemic circuit. Does that make sense? And if you pressurize one of the circuits more than the other, that means you're going to cause more leakage of fluid from the blood into the interstitium out of little gaps in the capillaries. So even in a healthy human, you're continuously losing a certain amount of fluid at the capillaries that comes from the blood but leaves the bloodstream. And this is one of the major reasons why you need a lymphatic system to collect that fluid that's been lost and put it back eventually into the bloodstream. That's what your lymphatic vessels are for. But here we have an unusually high case of leakage in the pulmonary capillaries because that circuit is being pressurized more than the systemic circuit because the left heart is weak. Left side of the heart. Okay, does that make sense? Well, when you have an abnormal amount of leakage from the blood and then therefore a pooling of fluid outside of the blood in the tissues, that's called edema, which can kill you, which is why the lymphatic system saves your life every day. If you didn't have the lymphatic system, you would die of edema very quickly because there would be this leakage from the blood but no mechanism to get it back into the bloodstream. So anyway, pulmonary edema results if the right side is outworking the left side because that pressurizes the pulmonary circuit. If just the opposite happens and the left is outworking the right side because something happens to the right side, then just the reverse situation, right? Now you're overpressurizing the systemic circuit. Pressure builds up in that and forces, by hydrostatic pressure, forces more fluid to leave through the capillaries than would normally leave through the capillaries, and that causes systemic edema. So when you have swelling that occurs, sometimes it's the result of edema, which is why, you need to pay attention to that. But let me make sure that is the show. It is. Pretty good timing.